abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, February 12th, 2014, Lincoln's birthday. And we are joined today by who else? Tom DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, as well as Lincoln Unmasked and many other books on other historical and economic topics. Stay tuned after my chat with Tom for a word about the mystery guest we're going to have on the 100th episode of this program coming up next week. I'm going to reveal who that is and how you can ask that guest your question. So stay tuned after I finish talking to Tom, who is, in addition, a professor of economics at Loyola University in Baltimore. Tom DiLorenzo, happy Lincoln's birthday to you.
Same to you, Tom.
All right, I figured there's nobody on earth I would rather have to talk to on Lincoln's birthday than Tom DiLorenzo, author of The Real Lincoln, and a scourge of PC professors everywhere. So it's going to be great to talk to you. But I want to start off and just ask the obvious question, which is, this book of yours sold a great many copies. It hit number 2 overall on Amazon, not in nonfiction, but overall. I mean, that includes fiction books. It includes books promoted by Oprah. It includes cookbooks. And you hit number 2 with this book. It's unbelievable, given that it's exactly the opposite of what people are told to believe about Lincoln. Why do you think a book like this has made you into such a lightning rod?
One reason is a lot of people don't like to admit that they've been made fools of their entire lives by the educational system. And rather than confront reality, they strike out at the messenger. And I think it's basic human nature on the part of some people. Although I've had hundreds of emails, maybe thousands over the years, from people who told me, I originally felt like that, but then I just come to think that, thank goodness I learned these things before it was too late, before I'm dead, and I can pass these on to my children and grandchildren. And so it's not everybody. Of course, I have a lot of fans. As you said, I did sell a lot of books, and it's still selling pretty well, 12 years after it was originally published. But I think that's the main reason. A lot of people don't want to admit they've been made fools of. And then, of course, all the political parties have deified Lincoln for 150 years. And so he really is the face of the American state. It's what gives the American state moral authority in the eyes of especially the neocons. And so any criticism of any kind whatsoever, no matter how minor, is always met with a sort of an organized barrage of letters to the editor and scurrilous charges against the author of the criticisms and so forth. So I think those are the two main reasons.
All right, so this really gets to the heart of it then. Why is Lincoln, in particular, why is he deified by the political parties? Why is he somebody who's considered to be off limits? What does he represent for the regime that they want to preserve and they don't want an iconoclast like Tom DiLorenzo tearing down?
As you know, Tom, at the beginning of the American Republic, the big political debate was over a centralized or consolidated monopoly state, which the Hamiltonians wanted, or the Federalists, versus the decentralized, limited government of Jefferson. And that battle was played out for many decades, and the Hamiltonians finally won with Lincoln. We got a highly centralized state. The rights of secession and nullification were effectively destroyed. We had the first income tax, the first military draft during the so-called Civil War, and an explosion of government compared to what it had been before the Civil War. And there's even a liberal law professor named Fletcher who wrote a book on Lincoln and the Constitution where where he praises to the treetops the fact that Lincoln provided a sort of a roadmap of how a president can just plain ignore the Constitution and essentially declare himself dictator and use the military to intimidate judges and members of Congress. As you know, Lincoln had a member, his biggest critic in Congress, Clement Vallandigham, a congressman from Dayton, Ohio, deported. And he also intimidated federal judges, even the Chief Justice, by threatening to have him arrested after he wrote an opinion that his Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus was unconstitutional. And so he attacked the separation of powers, he ignored the Constitution, and I think statists of all kinds, whether they're the neocons today or the Obamunists, as I call them, I think that's why they love the idea of idolizing Lincoln, because he was our dictator.
All right, Tom, I want you to pretend that there's a debate going on over Lincoln. It's a formal debate, and you have your opening statement. I want you, in that opening statement, give me the 30-second version of the traditional sort of schoolboy version of Lincoln, and then take another minute and a half to just, in the most basic terms, chip away at it.
Well, the traditional schoolboy interpretation of Lincoln that I was taught growing up in Pennsylvania public schools was that he suffered his entire life thinking about the poor slaves in the South, and essentially God sent him to Earth is a sort of a modern rendition. Now, God sent him to Earth to do something about this, and he finally got a chance to do something about it by becoming president, and he did. And then the reality is that Lincoln never said a word about slavery until the mid-1850s when it became politically opportunistic to say something about slavery. But he never opposed the Southern slavery. He opposed the extension of slavery into the territories. And the reasons he gave for that was that, one, they wanted to preserve the territories for free white labor. Those are his exact words. So it was political protectionism. They wanted to promise the white male workers that they would not allow any black people to compete with them for jobs, free or slave. And his own state, for example, amended its constitution to prohibit the immigration of black people into the state, and Lincoln supported that. And when he became president, anybody can just read his first inaugural address to find out why he decided he needed to go to war. He bent over backwards defending slavery in the first inaugural address. I call it his Slavery Forever speech. He even pledged his support of a constitutional amendment that would have prohibited the government from ever interfering with slavery ever in his first inaugural address. But when it came time to tax collection, he said there will be there need to be no bloodshed or invasion of any state. He used the words bloodshed and invasion to describe what would happen if any state seceded and failed to continue paying federal tariff taxes. So he literally threatened waging war on his own people over tax collection in the same speech where he gave the strongest defense of slavery ever made by an American politician, because it came from the president. And then he commenced the waging of total war against civilian populations of the South, reversing a decades-long tradition in the world of condemning that very practice of waging war against civilians intentionally. And so he really opened the door to the horrors of total war in the 20th century.
Tom, I want to review just generally what some of the critics said to you when your book came out. And I'm going to leave out of the picture the, I guess, what I'm increasingly calling the New York Times libertarians. Libertarians who think we can't say or do anything that might make New York Times readers not immediately flock to libertarianism. You know, these people are not our natural audience to start with, but we're supposed to cater to them in obsessively. I'm going to leave them out of the picture because I don't care about those people. But I am interested in the response among some historians, because it seems like they couldn't decide whether the correct way to respond to you, well, leaving aside people who just thought ignoring you was the way to respond, but they couldn't decide whether the way to respond to you was to say, look, DiLorenzo isn't saying anything new about Lincoln. He's just saying things that all historians already know about Lincoln. And then on the other hand, you have people saying the completely contradictory thing that, oh, That DiLorenzo, all he does is distort Lincoln. Well, which is it? Is he telling us things that all professional historians already know? Or is he distorting the Lincoln legacy? Like, did you notice that basically the complaints fell into these two mutually contradictory categories?
Yeah, I've read quite a lot of the so-called Lincoln literature, and what it is, you know, the historians can all know these facts. The references in my book, the 550 footnotes, are almost exclusively scholarly publications, university press books. There are dozens and dozens of them, journal articles, things like that. So the historians know these things, but they spent 150 years putting the proper politically correct spin on all these facts. And so I come along, and with my background in Austrian economics and libertarianism and public choice and political economy, make some real obvious statements about how a bunch of BS a lot of these interpretations are about Lincoln, and they don't like that. I can recall a week after the book came out, I had an email from Paul Craig Roberts, the syndicated columnist at the time, and he said, "You destroyed their human capital. That's why they're attacking you." And that's what he meant by that, is I had a different interpretation of the same facts. I'll give one example. Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's sort of established herself as the high priestess of the Lincoln cult, in her book, Team of Rivals, a big, fat, 1,000-page book, she talks about how Lincoln was actually the author of the Corwin Amendment that would have prohibited the federal government from ever interfering in Southern slavery. And it was named after an Ohio congressman named Corwin. So she uses primary sources to document that this came from Lincoln, who instructed William Seward. You know, this was after he was elected, but before he was inaugurated, to get this amendment through the Senate, which he did, and the House also. But her spin on it is not that. Oh my goodness, we've been misinformed about Lincoln. He was not such a champion of emancipation after all. Look what he did. He was willing to ingrain slavery explicitly in the Constitution. You know, that's the interpretation I get, or that I gave in my book. But what she said in her book is, no, we should praise Lincoln for this because it helped keep the Republican Party together, and that was very important, to keep the Republican Party together. And so you have thousands of spins like this of these same facts, and that are sort of the official doctrine of the history profession, and most of them are totally misinformed or uninformed by any kind of economic understanding. And so when I talk about Lincoln and tariffs and taxes and protectionism, the historians get especially angry with me over that, because all they have said really is that he was a good-hearted man and he wanted everyone to prosper like he had prospered. That's the basis of their economic analysis of Lincoln's policies.
All right, let me throw at you the most common and by no means unreasonable, but sort of the most common argument that the man on the street might come back with, which would be that, yes, look, I agree with you. Lincoln had various motivations for the things he did, and he was by no means an abolitionist, and he was willing to accept slavery in some circumstances if he could get other things that he wanted. I'll accept all that, and I'll even accept that for a year and a half into the war, he wasn't even interested in getting rid of slavery. Even then, he would have taken the Southern states back and not said a word about slavery. I'm willing to go with you on all that. But the fact is that the war gave an extra push to the abolition of slavery. And in the absence of that, there is no indication whatsoever at all in the economy of the South that the slave system was in any way dying out or not prospering. So, yes, it's true. We can talk all day long about the problems with Lincoln. But the fact is, the slaves were freed, and there does not appear to have been any serious prospect of their emancipation in the absence of the war. So what would you say to that?
Well, I would say, first of all, anybody who's interested in this question should read Jim Powell's book entitled Greatest Emancipation, describing how all the other countries of the world ended slavery peacefully during the 19th century without a war. And then also... it was understood by a lot of people at the time that Southern secession provided a huge boost to the downfall of slavery, because it would have made the Fugitive Slave Act inconsequential. The Fugitive Slave Act was a federal law that was very strongly supported by Abe Lincoln, that forced Northerners to run down runaway slaves and essentially return them to their owners. The magistrates were paid $10 for deciding to return a slave to his owner and $5 if he freed him. And so that was the incentive that was given. But if the southern states had seceded, that would have been defunct. And so a slave from Virginia, for example, if he escaped into Pennsylvania, he would be a free man forever. Whereas under the Lincoln regime and Lincoln's support of the Fugitive Slave Act, if that slave escaped into Pennsylvania, he had a federal bounty on his head. And that's why the Underground Railroad ended up in Canada and not some northern state. And so a real statesman would have done what the British did and the French and the Danes and the Dutch and ended slavery peacefully through some sort of compensated emancipation. And all the northern states did it that way. There were slaves in New York City until 1853. And so I never bought the idea that it was absolutely impossible for the southern states to do what all the rest of the world, including the northern states, did and put an end to slavery peacefully. And in fact, in my book, on the top of page 275 in The Real Lincoln, I wrote that the one unequivocal good that came of Lincoln's war was the abolition of slavery. Those are my exact words. But then the next sentence, I said, but he did it in the absolute worst way by antagonizing the South and poisoning race relations forever and commencing and attaching the ending of slavery to a war that killed as many as 850,000 Americans, according to the latest estimates, as many as that. And so that's just a mind-boggling number in terms of the amount of deaths that I think were unnecessary if the objective was just to put an end to slavery.
Tom, you and I have sometimes been called neo-Confederates. I confess I haven't got the slightest idea what this is supposed to mean. I don't favor resurrecting any old government. I don't favor the government I live under now, so I don't understand where this comes from. But can you try and shed light, not on what the word means, because it obviously doesn't mean anything, it's just a term of abuse, but what do you think the origin of it is? What are people trying to do by using this label and applying it to people?
Yeah, well, what they're trying to do is they're trying to address people who have not read anything hardly on the topic, certainly not read my book, and they're trying to get them to discourage them to even consider reading my book or reading my articles by using this word neo-Confederate, and by which they mean slavery defender and racist.
Right.
So you know he's a racist and a slavery defender. So don't pay no attention to anything he says. And I can recall getting another email, maybe a year or so after The Real Lincoln was published, from Morgan Reynolds, an old friend of mine,
who's
a retired professor at Texas A&M. And he was just marveling over it. He wrote me one email and he said, now they're picking out these picayune things. Like, I think one guy even criticized me because there was a typo in the index, in an incorrect page number in the index. And so these people were even combing through the index of the book looking for typos. And then a week later, Morgan writes again, and he says, holy cow, now they're calling you a neo-Confederate. So I went through a year of all this, these criticisms. They first started ignoring me, and then they started, personal attacks. And then at one point, a lot of these people were saying, he's making it all up. Lincoln never said these things, never did these things. But then the evidence was so overwhelming, they started saying, well, yeah, he did do these things,
right.
He did say these things, but DiLorenzo gives the wrong interpretation. It's not the politically correct interpretation. And then they must have thrown up their hands and said, well, let's just call him neo-Confederate, he's a slavery defender. And even though, no one to this day, as far as I know, has ever pointed out that the great African-American economist Walter E. Williams wrote the foreword to The Real Lincoln. And they never quote my statement on page 275 that the one unequivocal good of the war was the abolition of slavery. And as far as neo-Confederate, if you look at the index to The Real Lincoln, there are only four pages where the word is even mentioned, because it's not a book on the Confederate. It's a book about Lincoln and contrasting the real Lincoln from the fairy tale Lincoln. And all I said about the Confederates was that their constitution was almost identical to the U.S. Constitution, with the exception of the outlawed protectionist tariffs and the outlawed internal improvement subsidies, and they eliminated the general welfare clause that exists in the U.S. Constitution. And I also said that their constitution would have rendered impossible Lincoln's economic agenda of protectionist tariffs and internal improvement subsidies. And that's it. That's all I said about the Confederates. And so somehow that's some sort of great defense of the Confederacy and everything it did and everything that it stood for. And so it's just nonsense, but it's name-calling, and it's just libelous is what it is.
Well, you've written, we'll have to have you back to talk about it, but you've, of course, also written a book on Alexander Hamilton, who's in a very distant way the father of the whole centralizing ideology of which Lincoln is a part. Your book, Hamilton's Curse, is a great one that I enjoyed very much. As I say, we'll have you on to talk about that. But, of course, there are more people you could write biographies of that need to be written. I mean, more revisionist biographies. Of course, Henry Clay would be a natural candidate who comes to mind. And yet, in each case, as you say, it's not like you have to go out and find manuscript collections that were never consulted before or sources that have only now come to light. You really can draw a lot of this from the secondary literature. You can draw a lot of this from the professional historians who do this for a living and just connect dots that are rarely connected or bring out features that just, they may be in the professional historians' books, but they're not in your fifth grade class, they're not in your 10th grade class, they're not on the TV, and that's the service that you're performing here.
Yeah, that's the way I see it. You know, like Ludwig von Mises once commented that in one of his writings that, you know, typical historians are just sort of collectors of facts, but without any sort of theory with which to interpret the facts, you can really go astray and not get the right story. And that's the importance of economic theory, von Mises said. And that's one of the, you know, where I'm coming from, and it's where a lot of what your work is too, Tom. And that's why we have very different interpretations. And you mentioned Henry Clay. You know, I'm probably going to write a book about Henry Clay. But one of the standard lines about him is that he was a great compromiser. You know, he's known as the great compromiser. And one of the things he compromised was the so-called Tariff of Abominations that was in the early 1830s. He compromised a lower tariff after the extreme 45% average tariff rate that had been put in. But what the historians don't mention was that he was the author of the tariff bill in the first place. So they give him credit for being the compromiser that fixed this horrible blunder, but they don't mention that he was the source of the blunder in the first place.
Right, he's backing away from his own proposal.
Right, that's right. And he was also the chief warmonger that got America into the War of 1812. And if you read his latest biography, again, he's praised to the treetops for being on the committee that negotiated a peace settlement with England at the end of the war, but they don't mention that there probably wouldn't have been a war if it weren't for him.
All right, one last thing before I let you go. Can you tell people about the work of Philip Magnus over at American University relating to Lincoln and what was going to happen to the slaves after the war, like what he was planning to do with them during the war? Like, what has Philip Magnus dug up that we didn't know about before?
Yes, well, Philip Magnus is the co-author of a book called Colonization After Emancipation. And, you know, it's well known among the historians, the mainstream historians, that for much of his adult life, Lincoln favored what was known as colonization or deportation of the black people. He was a member of the Illinois He was a manager of the Illinois Colonization Society when he was in state politics, and as president, he even funded an office to start the ball rolling in deporting black people to Liberia, and he even had a meeting with some free black men in the White House, which was one of the very first times that black people had ever been in the White House. Urging them to go to Liberia, set an example, leave the country, go to Liberia. And these men all said no thanks, very wisely. But the standard interpretation by the history profession is that, well, yes, he did these things. He favored colonization, which is really, you know, it doesn't get much more of a white supremacist attitude than that, deport the black people. But in 1863, the story goes, he had some sort of divine transformation of his mind where he gave up all this. And so they don't explain, they don't give any evidence, there's no quotations, they don't quote Lincoln as saying this or anybody else as saying that. They just make it up that, well, 1863, he sort of, you know, he didn't talk about it much after that. And so for 100 years or more, that's been the standard story about Lincoln and colonization. But what Philip Magnus did and his co-author from Oxford University in England is they went to the National Archives in Washington and also the British Archives, and they found correspondence between Lincoln and the British government and other governments up to 3 days before his death, working diligently on figuring out some sort of plan for how to deport all the freed slaves out of the United States to send them to Panama or somewhere else in South America, the West Indies, anywhere but here. And William Seward was helping him out on that. They were even counting how many ships we had in the United States to put all the black people on, if it was possible to send them all out of the country after that. And that also tells you a lot about what Lincoln did with his rhetoric when he talked about equality. Whenever he talked about equality, he, of course, did not believe in equality. But he always had a qualifier in there of the sort of thing he would say, in their native clime, black people could be equal. That is, if they're all back in Africa, they could be equal with each other there. But racial equality here, no, that was never his position. So Philip Magnus, in this great scholarly piece of work, Colonization After Emancipation, proves that the entire history profession was full of it.
Yeah, now, let me jump in on this, because in your book, I think early on, or at least somewhere in your writing, you've estimated how many books have been written on Lincoln over the years, and it's in the tens of thousands of books.
Yeah, I quoted Lerone Bennett Jr., the author of an even more scathing critique of Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln's White Dream or something?
And saying that there have been 16,000 books written about Lincoln already.
Okay, all right, so it's a preposterously large number. And I mean, not one of these authors found these documents in the archives. They've had 150 years to look, and not one of them both found the documents and had the honesty to report on them. I mean, and these are the people who are coming after you. That is a badge of honor, then.
Yes, I agree. In the real Lincoln, I looked at what some of the real big shots in the sort of the Lincoln, I call them the Lincoln cult, had to say about this colonization. And one of them is Gabor Borat, who's I think he's the head of the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College. So he's quite a big shot in the whole Lincoln field. And I quote him as saying, he had to confront this because the facts, historians know this, that Lincoln advocated colonization for most of his life. And what Gabor Borat said is, this is how honest people lie. Those are his exact words from one of his books on Lincoln. He claims he was honest. He couldn't admit that Honest Abe was not honest. So he called him honest, but he called him an honest liar.
Yeah.
Which is another way of saying the ends justify the means.
Yeah,
it's okay
of course
to lie. Yeah.
All right, look, Tom, I'm going to let you run. It's been great talking to you. I mean, this is a Lincoln's birthday observation that is different from anybody else is going to get anywhere in the country. We have you to thank for it, both for being here today, for writing that book, taking all the slings and arrows, and firing right back at them even better than you got. And I sure appreciate that. I hope everybody will run out and read The Real Lincoln. Thanks again, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. I'll be burning him in effigy in my front yard tonight.
All right, that's the spirit. All right, everybody, that was Tom DiLorenzo. Don't forget the discount code available just to listeners of this program when you subscribe to my libertyclassroom.com. You want to learn real history and real economics, the kind that we should have gotten in school but we didn't? You can do so easily, on the go, in your car, in courses that are taught by me and by people I trust. LibertyClassroom.com is the website, and the discount code is SHOW in all caps, S-H-O-W in all caps. LibertyClassroom.com is the place to go. Don't forget my upcoming events, March 1st at the College of Southern Idaho, March 5th at Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, March 15th at the University of Central Arkansas, and then in April, we're working on a couple of dates, one in South Carolina, one in Florida, so stay tuned. Make sure and subscribe to this program on iTunes or Stitcher. And finally, who is going to be our special guest on the 100th episode of The Tom Woods Show next Tuesday, February 18th? And the answer is Judge Andrew Napolitano will be joining us. You want to ask the judge a question? ask him a question over on my Facebook page. I will be opening up a thread for questions for the judge. So make sure you follow me on Facebook, or make sure you like my page, that is. Don't look for me as Tom Woods on Facebook. My Facebook page, unfortunately, is Thomas E. Woods Jr., and you can get there by just typing in facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, or by going to TomWoodsRadio.com and clicking like on the Facebook widget that you'll find there, and that's how you'll be able to weigh in with a question you'd like me to ask the judge. A lot of times I go to the listeners for questions, and I fetch them via Facebook. So facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, or you can tweet them at Thomas E. Woods. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.